you're about to hear some of the most outrageous untold history of the Rock Hall of Fame. On the show right now, the founding curator of the Rock Hall of Fame, Craig Inciardi. Hey, Craig.
Hey, good morning, guys.
Morning.
How did I love the story of how the Rock Hall of Fame started. Can you run us through that a little bit?
Well, a young attorney named Susan Evans approached Ahmet Erdogan, one of the founders of the museum, who discovered Ray Charles, signed Led Zeppelin and the Stones, Ahmet Erdogan, and they started doing the induction ceremonies in 1986. And 10 years later, they opened a museum in Cleveland that's 125,000 square feet.
Okay. But no, didn't they reach out to you and ask you to get stuff?
Yep.
So, and like there was no museum.
There was no museum. I was working in the auction world at Sotheby's at the time. This was 1991, and I was hired to build the collection for the museum. First day in, I went to go see what they had, and literally they had one guitar of no importance and a couple of sheets of paper. So I knew that I had just a real... I had a lot of work ahead. I broke out into a cold sweat, not realizing that they basically had nothing. And I truly did have to start from scratch. And, you know, the book basically tells the adventure of building the collection, meeting with the artists, their families. That's how it happened.
Right. Well, what is... one of the most prized possessions that you were able to secure for the museum?
There's two that come to mind. Jimi Hendrix's original handwritten lyrics to Purple Haze.
Whoa. That is awesome.
So
yeah. The original version, the song was called Purple Haze, Jesus Saves. Hendrix had crumpled it up, thrown it in the garbage, and one of his roadies realized how important it was, took it out of the garbage, flattened it out, and gave it back to him. So he did ultimately keep it himself. That's one of the items that I was able to secure very early on for the museum. Around 1991.
How did you track that down? Like, where did that... go ahead.
It came from an auction that I was working on at the time at Sotheby's. And I convinced Seymour Stein, one of the other founders of the museum, to buy it for the museum. He signed Madonna. He discovered the Talking Heads and the Ramones. And he was a collector of Art Deco furniture. So he was already a collector, and he realized the importance of the Hendrix lyric. Another item that
I got... What did he pay for that at that time?
He paid $14,000.
Wow.
And I would say it's worth over $1 million now.
No kidding. Wow.
Good markup.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's interesting that the roadie had the insight to know that that was valuable then when Jimmy was still alive. You know, typically you don't think about that stuff until after.
Yeah. I mean, I guess this gentleman knew Jimmy and knew the importance of the song and just had the sense to keep it because there were plenty of people around that wouldn't have bothered or not noticed. And there's been so many items that I've been able to save. I'll give you an example. Joe Strummer's, a whole bunch of his lyrics were rotting in a barn being eaten by rats. And I saved them, from literally being a meal for a rodent.
Wow.
Damn.
How did you find out where they were?
His family brought me to his estate, and they had an amazing collection that was well cared for. But, you know, they led me to a barn and said, look around and forage around in here. You never know what you'll find. And on a rainy day in a part of England called Somerset, I found a stack of Strummer's manuscripts in a trunk that was filled with water. And, you know, the edges of the paper were chewed on by animals, but there was still enough left to salvage. And those manuscripts are at the museum now in Cleveland.
Craig Inciardi is on. He is the founding curator of the Rock Hall of Fame and author of Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, The Outrageous, Definitive, and Untold History. We're linked up at WPLR.com. You're kind of like the Indiana Jones of, like, rock memorabilia, correct? Like, you right. have to hunt this stuff down. Do you have the hat and, like, the whip? And
yeah.
I hold this behind
I
you.
I don't have the
spiders
hat or
crawling
the
all over you.
Well, I've had that kind of thing happen. I've had a lot of crazy things happen. But, yeah, the Indiana Jones moniker, you know, in its own small way, I guess, is true.
You once took a trip to meet Ozzy, right, to get something from him?
I went to his house in Buckinghamshire in 1996, and I met with Ozzy and Sharon and the kids. We were having tea in their drawing room, and I mentioned his guitar player Randy Rhodes, which was clearly a mistake because he was very upset and still mourning his loss. You know, he ended up exiting the meeting by jumping out a window. That meeting was short.
Were you blocking the door?
No. He had one of his RVs out below in the garden, and he clearly had kept it there for quick escapes when necessary.
Did he have a bottle of ketchup in his hand?
That's the last crazy Aussie story we had.
Jeff Tate.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, no ketchup on that day.
Okay. Well, didn't he have a gun one time? You arrived and he was, like, dressed in black, waiting in the dark.
When I arrived, Sharon had sent a chauffeur-driven Rolls Royce to take me from London to their house, and he was in the driveway with a rifle, but it was a BB gun, and he was pretending to shoot birds just to get a rise out of me.
Him and birds.
Dressed all in black. Looking fantastic.
You know, there's a real hunger for these stories now as we get to this point where all of these great artists, and we were like dripping in this wealth of great rock artists in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. People have a hunger for it. We're making documentaries now. This seems like it lends itself to a documentary.
Conceivably. There's the book is certainly a blueprint for that. But it's early days. The book has only been out 2 weeks. But it is a possibility.
Yeah. Good. Tell us about.
I would certainly love that.
Yeah, I would, too. I would just love to see the stories of, you know, all of these items collected. There's a lot of different ways you could shoot it, too. You could shoot it. I have a lot of ideas. Back to you. Anyway, why don't you tell us about securing John Lennon's glasses, the glasses that he wore the day he died?
So in the year 2000, we were creating an exhibit about John Lennon's life and his solo career. And I had to transport from the Dakota to Cleveland, several very important artifacts. This is, mind you, this is the pre-9/11 era. So I hand carried the bag of contents from the hospital when he passed away, the clothing and his bag that he was wearing, but they were sealed in a hospital evidence bag. Yoko Ono had never opened them up. In addition, she handed over the glasses that he was wearing that terrible day. So I brought them to the airport, literally pushed them through the the scanner, the conveyor belt, and arrived in Cleveland. The glasses were stored in a steel metal case and were on exhibit in Cleveland for 6 months.
How did that feel, carrying that stuff?
It was very sad, very strange. It felt very solemn. I had been entrusted to do this, so in that regard, I was happy that I had been chosen to bring the items to Cleveland and help curate the exhibit. It was an award-winning exhibit, and we have a catalog that was created, so there's still a lasting document from that exhibit.
AJ and I did a broadcast from the Rock Hall of Fame Museum twice. The first time was when Billy Joel was inducted, and we broadcast it out of the radio station that's built inside, which I think is a cool kind of nod to rock, is having a radio station inside the museum. And you know, it's odd the things that will strike you as you walk through the museum. Now you have the ZZ Top car, which is really cool. You've seen it in the videos, and the Bruce Springsteen American flag that was his back drape for the Born in the USA tour. And by the way, that flag is a lot bigger than you think. When you see it in person, you're like, wow, this is pretty massive.
Immense.
It was the twisted piece of metal from Otis Redding's plane that stopped me in my tracks. And I don't know why. I just couldn't move. I just stood there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that item has been at the museum since it opened. And it's, a large section of the Fluce Lodge with his name on it. It made its way to Cleveland. It's just a strange, thing, but it does mesmerize, people. One of the other items related to Otis Redding, that the family donated was the receipt for the fuel that the crew purchased on that ill-fated flight, because the stop before the crash was in Cleveland. And, it's just another connection to Cleveland.
Right.
It was obviously a major stopover for a lot of acts, either going out west or going east. You know, the Beatles, the Stones, the Doors, Bob Dylan all played in Cleveland in the 60s.
Well, the birthplace of rock and roll, where Cleveland is where rock got its name.
Yeah.
Alan Freed.
That's right. The Moondog Show.
Yep.
That's right.
Craig Inciardi is on, and he's got an awesome book out called the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, The Outrageous, Definitive, and Untold History. Of all the guitars you've touched through your life, what do you think is the crown jewel of guitars you've touched?
Well, it's tough to only name one, but I could quickly name three of them. Jimmy Page's double neck, his Gibson double neck that was used to perform Stairway to Heaven, obviously.
That's the Red Gibson.
This is the Red Gibson. Pete Townsend's J200 Gibson that he used to write Pinball Wizard.
Wow.
Eddie Van Halen's original Frankenstein, which he hand built himself in 1975, but those are just a few of many, many others.
Those are three amazing guitars.
Keith Richards' mean Telecaster Macabre, which is named after a character in David Copperfield. John Lennon's guitar from Shea Stadium. It's endless.
Is there an item that you've always wanted to get that you haven't been able to secure?
Well, I would say at the top of the list was the original manuscript for Stairway to Heaven, and I actually had a conversation in Cleveland with Robert Plant about it, and he just felt that if the public saw the manuscript and saw the words the way he had written them down, that it would demystify the song. So he said that he wants to keep them under lock and key and out of the public's eye.
That's understandable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess. Yeah.
Respect.
I heard that Jimmy Page cut three leads for that song. And, you know, the one that we heard that we can't imagine any other lead is the one that they ultimately use. But there are two others that we've never heard. Have you heard them?
No, I haven't. I'm not aware of that, but I could certainly imagine Jimmy Page. He did a lot of overdubbing and a lot of experimentation in the studio. So it wouldn't be surprising that he would have had other solos to lay on top of that section of the song.
Page wouldn't work.
Yeah. One of the other guitars that I was able to exhibit was the Harmony acoustic guitar that he actually used to write Stairway to Heaven. And he also used it on the intro, on the acoustic intro of the song.
Wow. Well, I could talk to you all day, but I can't because I got to go. But we'd love to have you back. Love the book. Love the whole idea of it. And I hope it's made into a documentary. Here's my idea for how it's shot. You get real footage from, like, the moment the item's being used. And then you go into your story of tracking it down.
I love it.
Yeah. I'll help you with it if you'd like.
There you go.
Yeah. Okay.
Craig, thanks, man. You're great. Good luck with the book. We're linked up at WPLR.com. Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, The Outrageous, Definitive, and Untold Story. Thank you, Craig.
Thank you.